Chapter 2 Tony passed gracefully through the hatch from the forward section of the Icarus, which contained various laboratories, agricultural bays, and storage lockers. Once inside the midship airlock, he pivoted in mid-flight and gently pushed off of the aft bulkhead of the airlock. He carefully closed the hatch and checked the seal, then slowly turned, scanning the other three hatches that led to the port airlock, aft habitat bay, and starboard auxiliary docking airlock. Satisfied they were all properly secured, he made his way up into the transfer tube that led to the LRV, closing and securing the hatch at the bottom of the tube behind him. As he pulled himself along, hand over hand, it occurred to him that he would not pass through this tube again for at least 2 months. It seemed funny that, even though they had all complained about their cramped living space, he would miss the familiarity of the Icarus after they reached the surface. Once inside the small airlock of the LRV, he secured the outer hatches of both the transfer tube and the LRV, then ascended one more level into the midship compartment between the flight deck and the passenger corridor. One last hatch to close, he thought, as he sealed the airlock's inner hatch. As he moved aft into the passenger corridor, he could see the rest of the crew securing themselves into their flight seats. At the back of the compartment, Mac, who minutes earlier had made a similar inspection of the Icarus from aft to midship, was settling into his seat in the last row next to Will. Tony looked at each of his crewmates, ensuring they were all strapped in, with helmet visors closed and locked, and life support packs in standby mode. Each of their faces betrayed their varying levels of stress. From Adia, who was scared to death and strapped in so tightly she could hardly breathe, to Mac, who, at the back of the compartment, was either too aloof or too stupid to be nervous. Tony turned and pulled himself down into his seat, attaching the thigh straps across his legs, buckling them into their receptacles just in front of his crotch. Pulling the tails of the thigh straps snug, he tucked them into their belt loops to keep them from floating about. Then he twisted his arms through the shoulder harness, first left, then right, and attached both the waist and chest buckles, pulling them snug as well.
"Everyone ready?"
"Ready as we'll ever be,"
Maria responded, with strained enthusiasm.
"Let's start this ride already," Mac insisted, with gusto.
Tony looked up at the flight status display on the forward overhead monitor. There were fewer than 5 minutes left before the Icarus would make contact with the upper atmosphere and begin its aerobraking maneuver. He was suddenly very conscious of the emergency escape tube to his right. If they had to abandon both the Icarus and the LRV in the event of a catastrophe, it was his responsibility to activate the system and get everyone to the emergency escape pod in the drop pod bay on the underside of the aft end of the Icarus. The entire evacuation process was supposed to take fewer than 2 minutes, after which the system would shut down, permanently sealing the fate of anyone left behind. That would be the hard part, of course. He wasn't supposed to wait for the flight crew. His job was to get the 6 other crew members into the chute and immediately follow them. Those were the rules, and he understood them. He just hoped he would never have to abandon the flight crew. Tony switched his comm set to the primary channel.
"Frank, this is Tony."
"Yes, Tony?"
Frank's voice crackled through the comm set.
"The Icarus is secure. LRV set at condition yellow. We're ready to go back here."
Frank looked at the ship's status board. No red lights.
"Copy that, Tony," he called through his comm set. "Stand by."
Frank looked at the mission chronometer, checking it against the LRV's chronometer.
"Ship is set at condition yellow, Jack. The board is green and all systems show ready. 1 minute to terminal course change."
"Very well," Jack responded. "Execute insertion burn."
"Executing insertion burn," Lynn replied.
There was a slight jolt that sent a shudder through the LRV, followed by the low hiss of chemical jets spraying their exhaust out into the void of space, causing a slight change in the ship's attitude.
"Deceleration engines are ready to burn," Frank reported.
"Insertion burn in 5, Jack started.
It was the last burn they would execute on their approach to Tau Ceti 5. It was also the only burn that would be done with their dedicated deceleration engines, instead of flipping the ship over to use their main engines.
4.
Without this burn,
The Icarus would be traveling too fast to execute her aerobraking maneuver, and instead would loop around the planet and be flung out the other side. 3. Fuel pumps are on. 2. D-cell is armed. 1. Execute, Jack instructed. Frank activated the Icarus's deceleration engines. He immediately felt a low rumble throughout the ship. It was nowhere near as intense as the deceleration burns they had conducted using the main engines, but it was coming from the front of the ship rather than from the back, so it felt more pronounced. All three of them watched their displays as the Icarus slowly altered her course and speed, coming to align itself with Tau Ceti V's upper atmosphere. 30 seconds into the insertion, Frank made the announcement. Coming up on PNR. Jack glanced at his flight display, checking that all the numbers were correct, before committing to the insertion. Point of no return in 5, Frank warned. Everything on Jack's flight display looked correct. Continue the burn, Jack ordered. I concur, Lynn replied. There was no turning back now. Continuing the burn, Frank acknowledged. For another 60 seconds, Jack watched the ship's speed decrease at the expected rate. D-cell engines cut off in 5 seconds, Frank announced. Jack smiled. They were going to end their insertion burn on schedule, at the exact target speed for aerobraking. The week-long process of deceleration was nearly complete. 3, 2, 1, Deco, Frank announced, as he tapped the button to kill the deceleration engines. The low rumble stopped, and the flight deck again fell silent. Insertion burn complete, Lynn announced calmly. Deceleration engines off, fuel pumps off, diesel engines confirmed cold, Frank reported. Jack turned to Lynn. That was perfect, Lynn. Absolutely perfect.
Thank you, sir, Lynn replied, a small smile forming at the corner of her mouth.
4 minutes to aerobraking,
Frank's voice announced over the comm sets. Maria checked her restraints again and glanced over at Adia, who was looking a bit pale. Adia reminded Maria of her own daughter, small and fragile. It saddened Maria to think of how long it had been since she had last seen her family, and how much longer she would still have to wait to see them again. 16 months was an eternity to be apart from those she loved. Her children would be a year and a half older, 12 centimeters taller, and a few kilograms heavier by the time she saw them again. She just hoped her husband wouldn't be a few kilograms heavier, too. He had been finishing off the children's leftovers from dinner when her back was turned. He was already getting thicker around the middle, which was a sin on the Daedalus. Food was strictly rationed, especially since they had begun to allow more offspring per family in preparation for their arrival.
Let's open the Balut Bay doors, Frank, Jack ordered.
Frank called up the Balut control display on his console. He activated the power for the doors, harnesses, and inflation systems, waiting for them to show ready.
Balut system shows ready. Opening Balut Bay doors, he announced, tapping the button on his console.
There was a moment of silence from both the crew and the ship. Then, from deep inside the bow of the Icarus, a low grinding sound transmitted from the bay door motors through the frame of the ship as they struggled to open the doors for the first time in over 60 years. Jack leaned forward slightly to see the bow of the Icarus jutting out below them. He watched as the topside doors sank slightly, kicking free the dust that had collected in their seams over the decades, and began to roll open from the center line outward. With the sun behind them, he could see nothing but dark shadows inside the bays as the doors parted. When the doors opened wider, sunlight reflecting off one of the approaching planet's 2 moons began to illuminate the deflated Balut's gold and silver metallic surfaces, causing them to shine brightly.
Balut doors open and locked, Frank reported.
He refrained from letting go a sigh of relief.
Inflate the Balut's, Jack instructed.
Frank activated the sequencer. The inflation rate of all 5 Balut's had to be carefully monitored to ensure they would be set properly when finished. If they ended up out of alignment,
The red-hot plasma created during aerobraking might leak through between the balutes and wreak havoc on the rest of the ship. Inflation systems charged, sequencer activated, pressures are coming up. Jack continued to watch through the forward windows as the balutes began to flap, as if blown from deep within the ship. Then, slowly, they began to rise. It was gradual at first, with the subtlest of surges, but soon they began to peek out from within their coffins, bulging outward as they took shape. He glanced over at Lynn, who was also watching, her mouth slightly open, in awe of the view from the bow. The balutes continued to grow, their folds disappearing as they rounded out into smooth patterns of gold and silver, with black bands covering their seams.
"Wow," Lynn whispered. "It's beautiful."
The balutes continued to expand as the pumps filled them with inert gas. 5 of them, one on each side, one on the top and bottom, and one around the bow of the Icarus. Frank watched his displays carefully as the balutes filled out, ensuring they were inflating evenly. Finally, the inflation was complete. The pumps went into standby, and the silent ballet came to a close.
"Balutes at maximum pressure. Alignment looks good. Harnesses look good. All systems show ready for aerobraking," Frank announced confidently, letting out a barely audible sigh of relief.
The port balut shifted slightly, its alignment marker offset from that of its neighbor. As Frank was about to point out the discrepancy, it spontaneously fell back into alignment.
"Probably just settling in," he thought.
"Very well," Jack commented, as he and Lynn settled back into their seats.
"1 minute to aerobraking," Frank added, tightening up his harnesses.
Jack's mind began to wander as he tightened his own harness. His thoughts drifted down to the planet's surface below. In a few short hours, he would be the first human being to set foot on an extrasolar, Earth-like world. The moment had not been important to him before. After all, his people had set new records every minute of every day since their voyage began over 3 generations ago. None of them, with the exception of the few remaining original crew members, had ever known a life outside of the Daedalus. All of their lives had been leading up to this moment in time. All to get to this system, perhaps even this planet. Lynn ran the aerobraking procedures over in her head. She thought about the things Frank had said to her after the last deceleration burn. He was right, she did lack experience, and the rushed manner in which she was trained for this mission also left her at a disadvantage. But she was the best pilot on the Daedalus, better than all the Ishkins combined. Her sim scores had proven that. She still couldn't understand what the others had against her, and longed for an opportunity to show them what she could do, what she was capable of doing. If they would just give her a chance.
"Fuel pumps on standby."
Out of the corner of his eye, Frank noticed the balutes shifting again. But before he could turn to look closer, they once again quickly fell back into place.
"Reactor plant safe at 2%.
Frank looked up at the mission chronometer.
30 seconds to aerobraking,"
their comsets crackled. Maria reached across the narrow aisle and took Adia's hand. It was pale, even for Adia, and it was trembling. Adia accepted her hand without hesitation, her helmet still pointed straight ahead. Maria wasn't sure, it was difficult to see Adia's face with her helmet on, but she suspected her eyes were shut. Sarah was also scared, but she wasn't about to let the others know, especially Mac. Surprisingly, she thought of her husband. Brad was a nice enough guy, not too bad looking either. He subscribed to the same traditions to which the previous generations clung so dearly, but at least he understood and respected her beliefs, even though he had tried to change her point of view on more than one occasion. Still, he wasn't really a husband, at least not in the true sense of the word. But then, the others weren't either. Most of them had learned to amiably live together after being assigned respective mates based on the genetics tables. But after 2 years of marriage, they had drifted apart, just as she knew they would. Sarah suspected that Brad was having an affair with his co-worker in the biogenetics lab, but at least he was being discreet about it. He even came to see her off, keeping up appearances for her sake. A few seats over, Laura wasn't necessarily calm, but she was under control. She wasn't the type to worry about things over which she had no control. She had grown up on a 60-year-old spaceship hurtling through the cosmos at nearly 20% light speed. There were so many things out there that could have killed them without warning, so worrying about the unknown could drive a person to insanity. Instead, she chose not to contemplate every possible danger ahead of her. Of course, she did think about her family. She and her husband had volunteered to bear extra children after the Daedalus had lost nearly one-third of its population to the Luton separatists over 2 years ago. Their fourth child had been only 1 year old when she had left on this mission. She hadn't wanted to leave her daughter at so young an age, but Dr. Wagner was just too old and weak to make the journey. And Dr. Wagner's son had joined the Luton colony. That left only her, and so here she was, about to ride along into history with the rest of the crew as they set foot on another world.
10 seconds to arrow breaking,
Frank's voice announced through their comsets. Mac noticed Maria holding Adia's hand. He reached over to Will and grabbed his arm.
Hold me, Will, he teased.
Oh, you're a pig,
Sarah commented, more as a reflex than out of real anger.
Oh, stop it, babe. You're getting me all hot, Mac sneered.
5 seconds,
Frank's voice warned. Sarah's defense of Adia was needless, as Adia hadn't heard Mac's teasing.
4.
Adia gripped her armrest even tighter.
3.
Tony shook his head in dismay at his friend's antics.
2.
Everyone braced themselves for the shock of atmospheric interface.
1.
Lynn braced the palm of her right hand against the butt of the control stick, not wanting to bump it during interface. Jack clutched the armrests of his seat as he continued to scan the instruments in front of him. Frank watched the mission chronometer as it ticked away the last second. 0. There was a slight bump. Then a distant rattling, lasting only a second or two. Then it came. A heavy thud that threw them all forward into their harnesses, nearly knocking the wind out of Jack.
Interface,
Frank announced, the word forced from his mouth by the sudden jolt. Jack glanced at the navigation display. A constant low rumbling followed the thud, reverberating throughout the ship.
How's our course, Lynn? Jack asked.
Lynn examined the navigation display carefully but quickly.
Down the middle, she reported calmly. Attitude is good. Altitude is holding steady.
Adia was now squeezing Maria's hand so tightly it almost hurt. Laura shifted slightly after the initial impact with the planet's outer atmosphere threw her forward against her chest restraints. She decided to tighten them. Sarah's eyes widened. She was having second thoughts. Will wasn't moving or reacting. He just held on tightly, his gaze fixed straight ahead on the back of Laura's helmet. Tony watched the flight display from his seat at the front of the compartment. He rolled his eyes and smiled as he heard Mac cry out from the back row.
Yee-haw!
Mac exclaimed, as the intensity of the vibrations rose. Frank watched as the external balut pressure and temperature increased rapidly. His eyes danced across his critical monitoring displays, from balutes to reactor to maneuvering, and back again. As the vibrations grew, it became more difficult to read his displays. He noticed the balutes shifting out of alignment again. This time, it stayed shifted long enough for him to be concerned before they settled back into proper alignment. Wanting to be sure that it was an instrumentation problem, he initiated a quick calibration check on the alignment sensors. It took only a few seconds. Unfortunately, the sensors reported to be in perfect calibration. Another thud hit the ship without warning, even harder than before. It was so pronounced that Frank glanced at the collision sensors, afraid they might have actually hit something solid as they plowed through the upper atmosphere of Tau Ceti V.
Jesus! Jack exclaimed. What the hell was that?
Jack had spent a lot of time in the simulator back in training. The sim operators had rattled their bones on more than one occasion, but it was nothing like this. The ship was shaking wildly, lurching from side to side, up and down, twisting and rolling. It felt as if it would come apart at any moment. Frank knew what Jack was asking.
"Everything is holding up so far," he promised.
Jack could hear the strain in Frank's voice. "What's the problem?"
"Upper port balut has shifted a few times, only for a second or two at the most."
"Should we be worried about this, Frank?" Jack asked, already worried.
"I'm not sure yet," Frank confessed. "It's not an instrumentation problem. I checked the calibration on the alignment sensors, and they're fine."
"Is there anything we need to do differently at this point?" Jack asked the question before Lynn had an opportunity to chime into the conversation.
"Not yet," Frank assured him. "Not as long as it keeps shifting back into place within a few seconds."
"Keep an eye on it," Jack ordered. Tony tightened his harness. That last thud scared the hell out of him. Probably even scared Mac a little, he thought.
"Damn, this is one kick-ass ride," Mac pronounced.
"Guess not," Tony mused. But Mac was the only one of them who seemed to be enjoying himself. The others were white-knuckled and pale-faced. The shaking grew steadily worse. Something wasn't right. Jack could feel it. It shouldn't be this violent. Not according to the aero-braking trial reports from 70 years ago, which he had spent hours studying.
"Frank, verify our altitude by radar."
"I can try, Jack, but it probably won't be accurate with the plasma wake out there," Frank warned.
"Oh, I should have known that," Jack thought to himself. "Can you get through it with penetrating Doppler?" he asked, pretty sure that Frank could.
Yeah, should be able to," Frank replied. "Give me a minute. I've got to write an interface loop to allow the nav computers to read the Doppler data."
"Make it fast," Jack ordered. The ship rattled and groaned, the extreme force of the superheated atmosphere blasting away at the surface of the balutes.
"On it," Frank assured him,
as he began entering code at a frantic pace, a difficult task since the ship was shaking so violently. A few moments later, Frank was ready.
"Penetrating Doppler coming online," he reported.
Frank called up the Doppler display on his left-hand console. Using the auto-sequencer, he called up a series of 6 pulses. It was more than double what he needed, but he wanted to be sure about the results.
"I'm sending down 6 pulses. Should be enough for the NavCom to get at least 2 separate readings on our altitude," he explained, as he activated the sequencer. "Pulsing now."
At the tail of the Icarus, on her underside, the Doppler dish unlocked itself from its safe position for aero-braking and maneuvered itself to point at the planet below. At its position, well aft of the plasma wake being plowed by the balutes up front, the frequency-compressed, high-energy beams the dish projected had the best chance of getting a clear reading through the highly charged ions being thrown off by the plasma wake. The first invisible energy pulse shot out of the Doppler emitter, bounced off the planet's surface, and returned to the dish. Even though the cycle was repeated 5 more times, the series was over in less than 2 seconds. Frank's mouth dropped open when the computer displayed the results as an expression of altitude.
"The altimeter is way off, by at least a few kilometers."
Frank turned to face forward.
"Oh, we are way too deep."
"Shit,"
Jack cursed.
"How the hell did that happen?"
It was a useless question at this point, and Jack knew it before he finished asking.
"Lynn, get us higher."
"How much higher?" she asked.
"Just start climbing," Jack ordered.
"We can't just pull up, just like that."
"I know," Jack replied, cutting her off. "I'll get you some new numbers as soon as I can, Lynn. In the meantime, just start pulling up, slow and easy."
Jack looked at her. She was scared, and she wasn't trying to hide it this time.
"You can do it, Lynn," he assured her in his most confident tone. "Just fly the ship."
Lynn had never before heard such encouragement from Jack, and was surprised at how comforted it made her feel. She took a deep breath as she deactivated the auto-flight system, letting it out as she flexed the fingers on her right hand and gently gripped the flight control stick.
"Pitching up,"
she announced, with renewed confidence. She gently pulled the stick back, releasing it almost as soon as she had touched it. The thrusters fired, but the ship didn't move. She looked down at the attitude thruster's status display. Even over the rumbling of the ship, she had heard and felt the thruster's fire. Looking at the display confirmed it. Still, they hadn't moved. She tried again, this time giving the stick a definite, less subtle tap. Again, the thrusters hissed, but still, their attitude didn't change.
"It's not working!" she exclaimed.
Jack was busy punching in numbers for a new aerobraking trajectory. If he didn't get the trajectory right, they would either bounce off the atmosphere and go hurtling off into space, or burn up in the steadily thickening atmosphere of the world below.
"Pull her up harder, then," he ordered,
as he continued to punch the numbers into the navcom. She tried a third time, pulling the stick back and holding it for a second. Then a fourth time, for a full 2 seconds. Then 3 seconds. Then 4.
"It's no use, Jack," Lynn insisted. "The attitude thrusters just aren't powerful enough."
"Okay, okay," Jack accepted, as he finished entering numbers.
He thought for a moment, as the navcom calculated a new trajectory.
"Try the OMS pods."
"The OMS pods?" she said in disbelief.
"Yeah, just like we were climbing to a higher orbit," he explained. "Orbit is a matter of velocity, not altitude."
"Yes, but we're not even down to orbital velocity yet," she objected. "We'll shoot off the other side, even at our current velocity."
"But if we increase our speed, we'll climb up into thinner atmosphere and reduce the stress on the ship."
"Yeah, and skip off into space."
This time, Jack didn't mind her comments and objections. It helped keep him focused, as his mind raced, trying to take everything into consideration.
"Once we get into thinner atmosphere, the attitude thruster should become more effective. Maybe then we can shallow out our trajectory and make this approach work."
"Maybe?"
Lynn objected.
"Better we skip off into space than burn up down here."
Lynn knew he was right. She also knew that debating the issue would only cost them valuable time. This wasn't like the braking burn incident. This wasn't a matter of ending up with just the right amount of fuel. This was a matter of life and death. Jack saw the resignation in Lynn's eyes.
"Spin up the OMS pods, Frank."
"OMS pods? Going hot,"
Frank answered back, as he switched the OMS master arm on and spun up the fuel pumps.
"OMS in 3, 2, 1, burn!"
The sound of the orbital maneuvering engines rumbled through the ship as they struggled to accelerate the Icarus against the drag of Tau Ceti V's atmosphere against her balutes.
"OMS pods are burning!"
"New trajectory coming up on the navcom,"
Jack announced. The new trajectory outlines danced across Lynn's screen, painting over the old lines. Lynn watched the flight dynamics display as the OMS pods burned, waiting for their velocity to increase.
"Come on," she mumbled. "Come on."
But the numbers didn't increase, only decreased slightly, as the friction of the balutes continued to drag them down. The shaking was becoming unbearable. Even with the comm sets, they had to yell to be heard over the intense rumbling of the plasma wake streaming past them outside.
"Jack, we're still losing altitude, even with the OMS pods burning,"
Frank told him.
"Damn," Jack thought. "There has got to be a way out of this."
His mind ran through all possible options.
"Frank, how much more of this do you think she can take?"
The question caught Frank off guard. Jack knew as much about the Icarus and her tolerances as Frank did.
"If we can hold this altitude, maybe 10 minutes, 12 tops."
It was a conservative estimate, but he was sure that Jack knew it.
"I'll tell you one thing," Frank added. "If we go much deeper, we'll fry for sure."
Jack searched his mind desperately, looking for some way out. But he kept coming back to only one option.
"Spin up the reactor, Frank," Jack ordered calmly. "Full power."
Frank wasn't sure what to say. He really wanted to caution Jack against bringing the reactor into play while the ship was being tossed about so violently. Antimatter was a difficult thing to contain, even under the best of circumstances. A breach in the electromagnetic containment field would end their worries once and for all, wiping all evidence of their ship out of existence.
But Jack surely knew what he was doing, didn't he? Had they thrown this same scenario at him in simulation runs?
Still,
Despite his preaching about timing to Lynn only a few hours earlier, he felt compelled to remind Jack about the risk.
Jack? He asked meekly.
Jack didn't even let him speak. He already knew what was on Frank's mind. It was on his mind as well.
I know,
he responded, as he continued to punch numbers into the navigation computer.
I know.
Reactor, coming up, Frank answered back, trying to hide the uncertainty in his voice. Lynn said nothing. This time she had no idea what to do, except try to maintain some degree of control as the ship plunged through the thickening atmosphere.
Bring the main drive online, Jack added.
He looked over at Lynn. We'll have to blast our way out of this, Lynn. Lynn silently nodded agreement. Either she understood the situation better than Jack had expected, or she was too scared to object. At the moment, it didn't matter.
Reactor at 100%. Mains are online, Frank reported.
Let's do it, Jack ordered. Light 'em at 25%.
Frank set the main engines as instructed, braced himself, and gently depressed the main engine start button.
Firing mains!
The main engines at the tail of the Icarus lit up in a brilliant yellow-white flash, their exhaust nozzles squeezing into a tight cone to increase their thrust. The main drive of the Icarus was quite powerful. Usually, it was not lit at more than 10%, the sudden acceleration considered unsafe for human occupants. But their situation was desperate. The sudden force of acceleration punched them all hard in the back. The atmosphere was fighting the ship's efforts to accelerate, the friction of the balloons working against them.
Mains at 25%,
Lynn reported, as she struggled to regain the air that had just been knocked out of her lungs.
Velocity still dropping.
Bring them up to 50%, Jack ordered.
She slowly pushed the main throttles forward until the display read 50%. The increased thrust pushed everyone back deeper into their seats, and the shaking grew even more violent.
Mains at 50!
She again watched the display.
Velocity holding steady.
75%, Jack ordered.
Lynn moved the throttle up a quarter more.
It's working, she announced. Velocity increasing. Slowly, but it's going up.
It's working, Jack thought.
That's it, baby. Come on.
There was a terrible shudder, followed by what felt like something being torn away from the ship. Frank looked over at the balut display. The port balut had shifted nearly 25 degrees.
Jack, the upper port side balut!
The entire flight deck lit up as the upper port balut began to tear away from its mooring points, allowing red-hot plasma to spill out over the Icarus and under the nose of the LRV. The plasma splashed across either side of the Icarus's upper hull plates, instantly burning away any unprotected protuberances on her surface.
The harness must be giving way, Frank hypothesized.
Condition red,
Jack ordered, without hesitation.
Back off on the throttles, Lynn. Keep her at just enough to hold our velocity, so we don't sink any deeper.
Condition red! Condition red!
Frank's voice sent shivers down their spines.
Set ships, condition red. Visors down. Life supports to internal. Hold on, people.
Back in the passenger bay, each of them switched on their internal life support systems. They were now sealed in their own private worlds, the sound of their own breathing interrupted by the occasional comment made over the secondary comm channel. They exchanged looks of fear and concern. Their looks all conveyed the same thing. Alarms began sounding all over the flight deck as numerous control and data feeds between the LRV and the Icarus began failing due to the tremendous heat of the plasma that was now spilling across the side of the Icarus.
I'm losing Icarus feeds right and left, Frank declared. Plasma must be seeping in between the LRV and the Icarus. Hull temp on her top side is rising fast.
Jack punched a few buttons on the navigation display, calling up the orbital position display. He commanded the navcom to overlay the landing site locations on the display. The primary site was already behind them. No good. They would need almost an entire lap around the planet to make that one, and at their current velocity, they would definitely shoot off the other side of the planet and out into space long before coming back around.
Laps were not an option. The secondary landing site was coming up too fast, and Jack wouldn't have time enough to put his plan into action. The tertiary landing site was just about to break the horizon. He queried the computer to display their ETA to the entry window for the tertiary landing site. The NavCom flashed a warning message at him in bold red letters. Entry approach profile not recommended. Unsafe.
No kidding, Jack thought.
Just give me the damned ETA.
The navigation computer granted his request a moment later. Confident that he had a plan of action, Jack straightened up in his seat and took a breath.
Frank, do we still have control of the cargo pod deployment systems?
What?
Frank asked, as his eyes darted back and forth across his displays, trying to keep track of what was happening to both the Icarus and the LRV.
The drop pods, Frank. Do we still have control of the drop sequencer?
Doubtful, Frank responded, as he double-checked his displays. I've got data feeds, but no controls.
Lynn, Jack said, as he began to unbuckle his harness. Try to hold her steady for 8 minutes, then separate and make for the tertiary landing site, whether I'm here or not.
What?
Lynn asked, completely confused.
Here, Jack said,
pointing to the entry point on the NavCom display, situated on the center console between them.
Follow this entry profile and try to make it to that landing site, he explained,
as he clumsily made his way up and out of his chair amidst the turmoil.
Understood?
He didn't wait for an answer, turning to head aft.
Where are you going?
Frank asked, surprised to see Jack out of his seat and moving toward him.
Send a mayday to the Daedalus, Jack instructed, as steadily as he could. Tell him we're dropping all pods, abandoning the Icarus, and trying for the tertiary landing site on TC-5.
Frank couldn't believe what he was hearing.
I'm going down to the pod bay to manually release the cargo pods when we get to the entry window,
Jack explained as he passed behind Frank.
With any luck, their internal nav systems will set them down near the tertiary site. Then we'll at least have a fighting chance.
What? Get your ass back in your seat, Jack.
Sorry, Frank. We need those pods.
And what about you?
Wait until the last second before you separate. I'll drop them early enough to get back up here before you reach the end of your entry window,
Jack promised.
Oh, bullshit,
Frank argued.
This is a really dumb fucking idea, okay?
Frank's voice grew desperate.
Are you listening to what you're saying here?
Frank, that wasn't a request.
Jack was done waiting and disappeared through the aft hatch. Tony was watching the display when he caught a glimpse of Jack in the compartment just forward of them, where he opened the inner hatch and dove down into the airlock. Tony strained to see what was going on, but could not. Maria also noticed Jack's departure, but said nothing, afraid to alarm Adia, who still had her eyes closed and her right hand clenched firmly onto Maria's left one. Jack made his way precariously down the transfer tube, bouncing off the walls as the ship continued to shudder and shake. The sensations of aerobraking were much more severe in the Icarus than on the LRV. He swung open the hatch at the end of the tube and passed through into the midship airlock compartment. Grabbing the handrail along the outer edge of the hatchway ring as he dove through, he held tightly and let his body fold at the waist, dropping his feet down below him. With his right hand still holding tightly, he swung the hatch closed with his left and spun the latch into its locked position. He moved across the compartment to the aft hatch leading into the galley and wardroom. After spinning the latch free, he pulled the hatch open and pulled himself through. He purposefully left the hatch open, wanting a quick return path to the LRV after his task was completed in the pod bay. He would have preferred to leave the hatches in the transfer tube open, but that would impede the LRV's quick getaway, should their situation get worse.
"We've got an outer hull breach on the port side, Section 12," Frank reported.
"Where's Section 12?"
Lynn asked, embarrassed that she couldn't remember.
"Just above the galley."
Frank acted quickly.
"Jack," he called across the comm set, "we've got an outer hull breach over the galley. Where are you?"
An explosion to Jack's right shook the entire ship, tossing him across the galley. He bounced off the starboard bulkhead and careened back across the galley toward the fire spewing out of the port wall.
"We've got a fire in the portside fuel transfer lines," Frank announced. "I'm shutting them down and blowing the SEP valves closed."
Frank frantically tapped at his console, ordering the pumps to shut down and the valves at the forward and aft ends of the line to permanently close.
"What will that do to our fuel status?" Lynn demanded frantically.
"I don't know yet," Frank replied. The Icarus carried almost two-thirds of her fuel in large tanks located in the aft section. But the electromagnetic ram scoop and the fuel manufacturing machinery was located in the nose, along with several large storage tanks that automatically transferred their load aft when the main tanks in the tail section were more than one-third expended.
"I can transfer using the starboard lines, but they can't match our fuel burn rate, can they?"
Frank didn't reply. Jack managed to catch the overhead rail again with his left hand. The sudden pull transferred his momentum and caused his feet to swing under him and over toward the raging fire. He could feel the heat through the boots of his pressure suit as he struggled to pull himself away from the jet of flames. Having regained control, he quickly pulled himself around and continued aft along the rail until he reached the doorway into the wardroom. He positioned himself at the doorframe, reached out, and slapped the fire suppression system activation button, but nothing happened. He pressed it repeatedly, but still nothing. Jack looked at the fire. It had a bluish hue, which told him that it was coming from the fuel transfer lines.
"Frank," he called over his comm set, "shut down the fuel transfer lines by the galley and seal them off at the valves," he ordered,
wondering why Frank hadn't already done so.
"I already did, Jack,"
Frank's voice crackled over Jack's comset inside his helmet.
"Well, they're still burning,"
Jack shouted, as he watched the inner walls begin to melt around the blue fire.
"And the walls are starting to melt down."
"My board shows them closed, Jack."
"Well, they're not," Jack insisted.
"I'll leave the transfer pumps on so the fire won't creep up the lines and blow our nose off,"
Frank decided.
"Jack, has the fire suppression system activated?"
"Negative. And I already tried the manual override. The whole thing is down."
"Is the compartment still pressurized?"
Frank asked. Jack looked across the room at the compartment pressurization control panel on the forward bulkhead next to the midship airlock hatch. Through the smoke, he could barely make out the little green light. The panel had its own sensor and didn't depend on any remote sensors to detect the compartment's pressure status. If that light was on, there was pressure in the compartment.
"Affirmative," Jack replied. "But if this fire burns much longer, the whole compartment will go."
Jack turned and floated through the doorway into the wardroom. There was nothing he could do about the fire right now. He had to get to the pod bay as quickly as possible.
"I don't have time to work this fire, Frank. I've got to drop the cargo pods."
"Tony, Mac," Frank called over the comms after switching to the secondary channel.
"Fire in the galley. Get on it."
"How's our fuel?" Lynn asked. Frank looked at the fuel level indicators on the main engine status panel.
"About 10 minutes at this rate of consumption," Frank reported, after a few quick calculations in his head.
"On our way," Tony reported, as he flipped open his chest harness and pulled his thigh straps free. He floated up out of his seat, his head striking the ceiling, as another vibration sent the ship lunging downward. He wrestled with the side handrails running along the inside edge of the port and starboard turbine housings, steadying himself against the constant, violent, and unpredictable motions of the ship. He pulled himself forward to the hatchway, turning sideways to see if Mac was coming. Despite his massive size and bulk, Mac moved gracefully in zero gravity and was right behind him.
"Let's do it," Mac declared.
Whether or not Mac's bravado stemmed from stupidity or real courage, Tony was just glad that his friend was right behind him as they moved into the airlock. Jack pulled himself along the overhead handrail, across the wardroom, and into the berthing corridor. He made his way to the far end, across from his cabin, to the access tube hatch leading to the pod bay. He opened the hatch and entered the long, narrow tunnel that led to the bay in the middle of the aft section of the ship, along her bottom. The tube was nearly 15 meters long and less than 1 meter wide. It was not designed to be accessed while wearing a pressure suit, and he bounced off the tube walls every time the ship shook. It was poorly lit, with a handhold every 2 meters,
so making his way through the tunnel safely was difficult, as the ship buffeted about in the planet's upper atmosphere.